Hey guys, it's Mandy with Global Hub Association. I just wanted to give a quick shout out and say thank you to all of our incredible sponsors. We couldn't make this happen without you. If anyone else is interested in sponsoring, don't hesitate to reach out to me. We can make it happen. Thank you again.
We're back. I haven't done these for a little while, so I'm really excited to see everyone on here. Wade, if you're still listening, hello. It's good to hear from you, or good to see you. I'm really excited about what we have going on here in the U.S. for 2023 in the hemp industry, and especially internationally for 2023. So I'm really excited about our guest today, Magic.
Magic.
See, Magic. I would butcher it.
No worries.
Magic. Close enough, closer to Magic. Anyways, I'm really excited to hear about your operations. I've been following you on LinkedIn. For those of you that aren't following him, please go over to LinkedIn and make sure you do follow or connect. He's got some great things he's publishing and exciting to see what's going on over in Poland. So I'll hand it over to you and let you kind of give a quick intro about who you are and what you're doing, how you got into this industry. And then, yeah, let's dive into to what you found out. Let's know.
Yeah, that probably answering this question fully would take the whole 60 minutes we've got for the talk. But basically, I've entered hemp industry when there was no hemp industry to speak of in Poland. Like basically, I started 20 years ago as a hemp advocate, as the educator, as a journalist, writing about hemp, making people realize that both hemp and marijuana, that they're basically the same, somehow connected. That marijuana is not heroin, that it doesn't actually kill you immediately, and so on and so on. And then for like 6 or 8 years, I was working as a journalist on hemp-related issues. Mm-hmm. And then I started, I got involved with politics. So it's like marijuana is legal. You can actually go up to 3 years in prison for possessing any amount of marijuana in Poland. So it was like ridiculous. It still is ridiculous. It's even more ridiculous now that Poles in Chicago can actually possess up to several ounces, but Poles in Warsaw cannot possess anything. I ran a political campaign to decriminalize at the beginning and then legalize marijuana. And I was saying it's tax money, it's job creation, it's actually marijuana is economy, is industry. And everyone was saying that's bullshit. You're just talking rubbish. It's not possible, because if it would have been an industry, someone would have been doing it. So I was like, well, maybe I should actually start the business to prove my point. And in 2014, I started my first hemp company in Poland. It was actually the first hemp Polish company. I was granted the license to operate, and it was like only a proof of concept. I only wanted to prove that it is possible to actually make money on growing hemp, on processing hemp, on selling the products out of it. And then somehow by accident, it became like my daily occupation. It was coincided in time with the material at CNN from Mr. Gupta about Charles Webb and so on. So everyone started looking for CBD products all over the world in 2014. You already had in the US something imported from China, but they were not happy with the quality. So one of the Polish entrepreneurs in Chicago connected with me, and she was like, can you produce CBD oil? And I was like, yeah, no problem. Sure, we can do it. I hung up and I asked my wife, what is CBD and how can I actually get it out from the plant? So it was quite funny, but quickly enough, we managed to raise some capital to start operation. We developed our own CO2 extraction facility. And it was actually a very good time and place to be in economic history, the short-term history, because quickly enough, Canadian companies were looking for something to buy out in Europe, and we were there. I was never building a company to sell it. It was never my intention, but usually those guys are actually the ones that are selling the company, because I actually built this for myself. It took me only 4 years to build a company from scratch, from seed money to 100 employees and something like $10 million revenue per year. It was sold to the Canadian company, which decided that they will have someone else as the CEO. So I was let go. And having a non-compete clause, it's actually, I'm the case of non-compete clause being a good thing for the industry and for the entrepreneur himself, because I was not able to do CBD. And it was actually a very good moment to get out of the CBD business early 2019. And I was like, well, I can only do hemp in my life. I know nothing else. So what is there else in hemp apart from the herbal part, from the cannabinoids? It was like fiber. Fiber was always, like in Polish, the non-narcotic hemp is called fibrous hemp, konopie włókniste, which means hemp that contains some fiber. So I was like, well, maybe we should start working with this fiber. And that's how Kombinat Konopny was started. I started with it with my seed money from which I got from proceeds from the sale of the previous company. And then we also entered a very successful crowdfunding runs, which helped get a lot of media attention and a lot of money. So basically a win-win situation. And right now I'm in the position of having a vertically integrated company with 40 employees. We grow our own, we process it, we make the end product. We are still in the herbal business because the non-compete clause is already long gone. So we are making a non-nonsense line of products. It's not CO2, it's not alcohol, it's like maceration, it's just infusion in oil. So very simple, very effective, very natural, and very cost-wise effective, like very cheap product, basically. I don't like the word cheap.
Because did you say infused? It's not extracted, it's infused?
Yeah, basically, like talking very in simple terms, you take the hemp biomass, CBD containing biomass, you take oil, we use olive oil, is a very good oil, you just put one with another, and then the cannabinoids as lipophilic substances, they just go to the oil and you just have to press it out. So it's like what the British are calling the cold pressed CBD, they are doing it for legal reasons to avoid the novel food restriction and so on. But we're actually doing it, and it's very cheap, and it takes all the cannabinoids, all the terpenes, everything that is of value in the biomass, it goes directly to the product. And since it is not expensive to produce, we can offer it also at a very competitive prices. Obviously not as cheap as imported worthless isolate. A real full spectrum, because it really is everything that there was in plant. But what might be more interesting for the US, people in the US, because you've got like the CBD market is too huge to even mention, is the other leg of our company, is the fiber part. We've already mastered the process of decortication, of basically growing the plants in a way that allows the fiber to be spinnable, because the end goal is the yarn. It's textile grade fiber, but not made in the traditional long fiber manner as it did in France or Romania, but also going with the same cost-wise idea that those products cannot be expensive. If we limit ourselves in the hemp industry only to those with a lot of money to pay for premium products, it will never actually get off. So we are hopefully looking at 6 to 9 months until we can actually offer a locally produced, maybe not 100% hemp. Right now we are looking at 70 to 80%. We still need some local wool or viscose. We can use cotton, but I don't want to use non-European products. And it's also a funny thing, because 3 years ago, when I started this company, I was telling everyone that we need to source everything locally. And people were like, why? Why is it important? And then COVID struck, Suez Canal was blocked, and Vladimir Putin lost his mind. So it actually proves my point that if something happens in the world, you cannot count on cotton from Uzbekistan. It's just not going to happen. And in 50 years, you cannot count on cotton at all. So you have to find some solution locally. So we are growing hemp, we are processing hemp, and right now we're already offering herbal products out of it. And next year, hopefully, we'll start offering hemp yarns as well for textile producers.
I'm impressed. Okay, so I have all kinds of questions. And I want to say also, we've got quite a few people listening. Feel free to chime in if you guys have questions. Darwin, I saw you're on. I hope your sound is working. Neil Herrick, it's good to see you. Bill, it's always good to see you as well. Thank you very much. So talk to me about supply chain in Poland. And you'd mentioned that you figured out a way to produce it so that it's providing that high grade or higher quality textile grade fiber. Can you talk to me a little bit about what that process is like and what sets it apart?
I cannot honestly talk a lot about the supply chain because we have all the supply chain internal in the company, because I think that one of the major obstacles to develop a new product is if you count on your supplier, then like, for instance, we have companies in Poland that are producing non-wovens. That's a much simpler product. It's like a felt kind of mat. And they are getting hemp from some farmers. They don't even know which part of the world it is. They are not even 100% sure if it's hemp. They just get some fiber. And then they can start working from this point, from the fiber itself. In my case, if I'm growing it myself, if there is something wrong with the fiber, I can go many steps back. I can actually go back to the seeds, variety selection, sowing density, timing of the sowing, fertilization. All those things are actually of crucial importance. So that's, someone might think, well, he founded the company 3 years ago and he's talking about yarn in the future. So what did he actually do with those 3 years? That was developing this lost know-how, because we cannot ask our parents how to do it, because we have like two generations lost. The last time we actually grew hemp for textiles was like 60s or 70s. By the way, Poland was the third biggest producer of hemp in the world in the 60s. But most of those people, unfortunately, are dead. And those that are still around, sometimes they're helpful, sometimes quite the opposite, because they remember the exact formulas from the 60s. And back then, growing hemp in Poland was considered an occupation to give something to the people so that they don't drink too much or don't fight with each other and so on. It's like immediately after the Second World War, we had to rebuild the economy and so on. So it's not wise to transfer the technological solutions from the 50s and try doing it right now in the current economy. But when talking about supply chain, I think the fact that we are producing our own material is a crucial advantage. I'm not saying it's not possible to do it without, but I would not be able to develop my fiber as quickly, as neatly as I'm happy with our achievements up to now. It would not have been possible if I would be basing on suppliers.
Sure. Well, and that's something that we've seen, right? From one field to the next, from moisture to not enough moisture, getting rain, not getting rain, and level of humidity really plays a role.
It's actually a good thing, because it allows you to adjust the product. If you know those things, it's like human intelligence is similar to artificial intelligence. You just need to put a lot of data. So I'm in the process of putting data into my AI internally.
Nice. Okay, so talk to me about what plays the biggest role in quality of textile fiber? Is it the redding process? Is it sewing density? Where would you say?
The redding process is actually more about the process of, because the quality of the end product is one thing and the price of achieving is another factor. So if you don't do your redding correctly, you can still get a good quality product at the end, but it will cost you a lot more because of the loss of material and of the energy input. So I wouldn't say rating is like crucial part of getting the product, the end product nice. I would say variety. Like if you get your variety wrong, you cannot do it. It's whatever amount of money or know-how you're going to put into it, you can make some non-wovens, you can make some cords out of it. Although cords, like many people in Poland are still thinking that that's the only thing that you can make rope out of hemp. Well, yes, you can make rope out of hemp, but it will be worse than polypropylene. It's simply, it's not going to compete with polypropylene, neither on costs nor on quality. So, but when it comes to textiles, you cannot make it from grain varieties, for instance. At least that's my experience. So variety selection, I know it is a bit different. I see Ken Elliott is asking about the genetics. Yeah. So we are basically, I was just about to tell that it's probably a bit different on both sides of the pond, because we have European varieties. You have some of the European varieties. From my experience in our climate zone, French varieties are absolutely the best for fiber. I'm currently using Fibron. It's a French variety, late flowering variety. So, and a typical fiber variety. We are also creating our own to accommodate for the climatic zone. I still have some wild hemp genetics from Poland, from Romania, because it used to be everywhere. So yeah. You can still find some local varieties which you can stabilize and use. Well, technically, legally speaking, you cannot use them because they are not in the catalog, but no one is asking. But whether the French varieties are possible to grow in the US, I have no idea. I've seen, for instance, Białobrzeskie. You have a lot of Białobrzeskie. That's a Polish variety. And however, I should be saying that the Polish varieties are good because I'm Polish. I'm unfortunately not so happy with Białobrzeskie. They're very strong plants for technical fiber, for insulation. They get very good yield, a very strong fiber, but not necessarily of textile grade. So I'll say Fibror is outcompeting all the other varieties that I have tested.
There were a couple questions. Ken also followed up with saying typical farm size for raising.
Typical. We have 3,000 hectares. We used to have 3,000 hectares 2 years ago. So it's like 7,000 acres. And right now it's 50% of that. And it used to be like 100 or 200 farms. So the typical farm size in Poland for hemp, just as for any other crop, is around 10 hectares. So it's like nothing, especially when you speak about fiber processing, straw processing, because for biomass, 10 hectares is actually quite a lot if you're processing it for yourself. But for fiber, it doesn't. Well, we are operating on 100 hectares at the moment, and that's like a minimum to have enough material for the line. We are not operating one of those huge processing lines. I'm rather one to claim that there should be many small facilities, like 1 ton per hour, or even 500 Ks per hour, not 5 tons per hour. Obviously, the best solution would be to have lots of large processing facilities. But right now, there are no processing facilities at all in Poland. So if you are a farmer, like a regular farm guy, and you want to start growing hemp, you will have no place to sell it, period. And that's probably one of the main obstacles for growth of this industry in Poland. And that's one of the reasons why we decided to build our own processing facility. I don't believe like in 5 years time from now, I will still be growing production hemp fields. I will still have my R&D like 30 hectares or something, but our aim is to develop so simple a technology for growing that I can ask local farmers to do it for us in a 30 kilometer radius, 20 miles. It's in order to not to pay for the transport, because like on one full trailer, you can put like 7 tons, 8 tons of straw. So there's no point of spending petrol, spending diesel to just transfer it all over the country. So yeah, I guess that answers the question about the farm.
Sure. John had a question too. And hello, John, it's good to see you. How small diameter hemp fibers are you making for spinning, and how are you measuring it?
Getting from the end of this question, how we're measuring it is we're actually using a very, very simple methodology of just looking at it through a microscope. And then you have like a metric glass and you can look at it. Obviously, I will not distinguish 20 microns from 22 microns, but I don't really care. I've seen like in Australia, they have a stock exchange, like mercantile exchange for the wool. And there's a huge difference in price between 18 microns and 20 microns and 16 microns. We don't actually standardize it because we have to cottonize the material. We are operating only on short fiber. That's an important factor. So we are dividing the fibers into smaller elementary fibers of like 4 or 5 centimeters long. And they are usually around 20 to 25 microns. But we don't have like a batch that is only 20 microns. You can get it with viscose. You can get it with polypropylene, with polyester, because those are man-made fibers. But with natural fibers, we have quite a range. They usually don't go below 20 microns. It is possible to do it, but then you have a length of unuseful. When you go below 20 millimeters, it's actually very difficult to do anything apart from non-wovens out there. So I would say 20 to 25 microns.
When you're talking about you're currently using short fibers, you said? You operate with short fibers, yeah. Is that right? What does that look like? What's the size? Talk to me about difference and spinning, you know.
Yeah, but the traditional way is long fiber. And long fiber, yeah. It's plants growing up to 4 meters. And that's actually too long because no processing line can accommodate 4 meter long stalks. So some people in Europe, especially in France, they are thinking about cutting the plant into 1.20 meter fragments because that's the regular standard European machinery size for linen. And basically people are thinking, well, let's do to hemp what we are doing to linen, and then everything will be okay. The crucial part is you have to keep the plants parallel. If you don't do it, you cannot operate with long fibers. So there's a completely different processing line. We don't do any of it. Because in my opinion, it's too much labor intensive. You cannot make cost-effective product this way. That's my opinion. I know many people are thinking otherwise. And I believe that the more people try different approaches, the better for the industry. Like as humanity will develop it more quickly.
Yeah.
But then what is short fiber then? We have explained what's long fiber. With short fiber, we are not collecting them in a parallel way. It's just random. We just bale it. And then all the plants are like that. We don't know how it's gonna end up in the processing facility. So we are tearing the plants. We're basically literally tearing those apart. And then we are left with fibers that are 10 to 12 centimeters long. And then we can use a regular carding operation. Carding is like almost 200 years of history without many important changes to the technological idea of a carding machine. And it used to be used. I don't know if that's correct in English, but basically you know what I mean. It used to be used for cotton and wool. Mm-hmm. So what we are doing, instead of developing a whole new machinery for one plant, we are actually changing the properties of the fiber to make it similar to wool or cotton. And then we can just use regular cotton machinery with just slight changes, because there is no such thing as a cotton machine. You have to set it up for precise batch of cotton. If you source your cotton from Xinjiang, it's going to be different than you source it from Uzbekistan or from Sicily. Then you need to make some adjustments. And you just treat cottonized hemp as just yet another type of natural cellulose fiber that needs some adjustment. And we're right now at this step. So I'm a bit ahead of myself talking about spinning it, because right now we have made like 2 inches of yarn, and then the machine broke up. And with it's like being well capitalized from perspective of a private person doesn't mean being well capitalized from the perspective of big industry. Like textile processing used to be huge enterprises. So we are like a small company. We are using old secondhand equipment, so we have some technological issues with that, but. Basically, I'm absolutely sure that we're going to overcome those.
Sure. So Darwin had a question when you were talking about size. Were those width of the bundles or the ultimate fiber itself?
That's a philosophical question. I would answer ultimate fibers, but that would have been a wrong answer strictly speaking, all fibers are bundles of fibers, but basically for Darwin, it's enough to understand that those are individual fibers. We're actually individualizing them. You can never be 100% effective in that, because by hand you can, but then you have like 10 grams per hour. Like, we need to be several, you understand, we have to work, we cannot work by hand.
Yeah, pounds, tons. Okay, so when we talk about, hi honey, when we talk about processing capacity that's needed per acre for raw material, and then right below that, there was a question wondering about the decorticating equipment that you're using and the output per ton.
Yeah, right now the output per ton, output per hour, I assume, output per hour in tons is around half a ton. So it's compared to the facilities I've seen on YouTube, at least in the US, in Montana, which have 5 tons per hour, we are like 1/10 of the size. But I believe that's enough for us. And going back to the previous question, it's actually quite easy to calculate that if you have one acre is like 0.4 hectares. So 1 acre equals around 4 to 5 tons of straw. And then if you have, let's say, 100 acres, then you have 500 tons, 220 days in a year. So you need 4 tons per day. So 500 kilograms per hour for 1 8-hour shift. We are actually operating on one shift only. I maybe like probably you're gonna switch to two shifts at some point. So basically, our 500 kilogram per hour is enough to work one shift for 50 to 100 hectares. So that's the range. And I believe, at least in Poland, I don't know the situation in the US, but that should be like the smallest industrial scale processing. Obviously, there are household processing technologies where you just grow 2 acres for your own personal use and you just build a shed out of the herds out of it. But we're not, that's not industry. That's basically hobbyists. But for the industry, I'll say 500 kilograms per hour is the minimum, and that's approximately 100 hectares, so like 250 acres.
Okay, so we talked about specs, herd. What are you doing with the herd, and how is it being worked into your business model and, you know, understanding the available markets there? Yeah, talk to me a little bit about what that looks like in Poland.
Yeah, I don't like selling raw materials because I'm doing that. I'm susceptible to being changed for another supplier, but we are simply not capable to operate on too many fronts at the same time. So making herbal products, making textile products, and making like building products out of herd, that's simply too much for me. That's my dream, my aim. It's like, it's 10 years now that I'm telling that in 2 years I'm gonna start producing building materials. So in 2 years I could start producing building materials out of it. But right now we're just selling it for construction mainly. I know that in the US the horses, like the
bedding,
what do you call it? Yeah, bedding materials are a major source to sell the herds. But in Poland, the owners of horses, we are trying to work them, but they are still reluctant. Some of them just don't want to overpay because when they compare it to hay, they just don't really seem to be interested. But the changes in prices of everything, I know you have it in the US as well, but we just bordering Ukraine, we really actually see it. We had like 70 or 80% of gas from Russia. So the prices are up really substantially, which is actually a good thing for a processor selling wood-like material, because wood, construction wood, is 200% up year to year. So the price of the herd today is so high that we're actually just selling it as a raw material because it allows to just pay for the electricity bill and so on. So I'm not very happy with it that we're just selling raw unprocessed hemp, just cleaned and to a fraction that the customer is asking. And I'm actually also not happy with the situation that I'm actually turning away 90% of the customers because we don't have the capacity to serve them. So there is like a huge demand for hemp heard in Europe, which I'm afraid will turn in 2 years' time into the same situation you have with CBD in the US at the moment. Because everyone is thinking now, well, if I'm going to grow 1,000 acres of hemp and turn it into herd, I will just make a lot of money. But the price will not be like that forever. So I'm not really, I know many people are now saying that we're not in the fiber business, but in the sheep's business. I'm not one of them. I still think that long term, it's the fiber that is the most valuable commodity in the hemp show.
Yes, well, and this is kind of why I brought it up, right, is that what is that tipping point, or when does that tipping point come on board where we should be, we will now have a flood of byproduct instead of the main material that we're selling, because we will have so many more companies or so many more processors that have developed technology to process across, around the world for a high grade or a high end textile grade fiber.
It's not a product that can be easily, especially sheaves, that can be easily traded worldwide because of the bulk volume.
Yeah.
But basically, I believe that we will, the prices will go down the moment someone will realize that there's quite a lot of money in it. Because like on the Polish market, when I entered the CBD in 2014 and I was looking for investor, everyone was saying, well, you're crazy. It's not going to happen in Poland. When I sold the company in 2018, everyone started a CBD company of their own because they saw someone actually exiting from investment. So right now, no venture capital or no people with substantial capital are investing in it in our parts of Europe because they have not seen a company exiting from a successful investment. So if that, when that's going to happen, everyone will come in, and all of those people entering at the late stage, they will just be losing money.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you expect straw yields to be 4 to 5 tons per acre or hectare equivalent? I think I heard you say,
well,
yes.
I wouldn't call it an expectation. It's like a, it's my experience. We get 10 to 12 tons per hectare, which is 4 or 5 tons per acre, if I call it calculated correctly. But straw, not fiber, that's important to distinguish.
Yeah.
Like straw is roughly 75% herd and 25% of the fiber. And what the people that are contemplating entering this business don't understand is you can never get 100% out of anything. If you have 75% in the plant of herds and 25% of the fiber, it doesn't mean you're actually going to have 750 kilograms of sheaves because you have like 10% of dust and everything.
Yeah, absolutely. Guy, thank you very much.
Fiber guy, yeah. Thank you, Guy. Yeah, yeah. I strongly believe that.
Yes, absolutely.
Fiber, yarn, textiles, apparel, yeah.
And then another thank you. How do you measure, how do you measure the soil? I don't know that we've really talked about the soil side very much.
Currently we're actually using manure. Is like a word for organic fertilization, fertilize. I know Ernest is from Lithuania. He probably mentioned fertilization. But basically we are using manure. We are using chicken's manure because our field is EU ecological certified. So we are not allowed to use chemical, like regular fertilizers. But basically what we are aiming for contract farmers is to use simple nitrogen fertilization. Because, and that's quite a complex thing that I'm going to say, winter redding that we're doing, because we are collecting our plants in spring. If you compare the nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium concentration in hemp straw after winter redding and before winter redding, there is a huge difference. All the potassium and phosphorus, it's actually got flushed out of the straw and it stays in the field. So the only thing that you're actually taking out of the field is approximately 100 kilograms of nitrogen. So in order to keep the balance for the next year, what you need to input is basically 100 kilograms of nitrogen, which is not quite a lot. In Europe, it's allowed to use up to 170 kilograms. And it is quite strange when you think about it that the plant doesn't need phosphorus and doesn't need potassium, which is a good thing. Taking the current prices of fertilizers, in at least in Europe, they got also 200% up, because basically the fertilizer is the cost of the gas. So if the gas goes up, the cost of fertilizer goes up.
Yep.
But honestly, I haven't seen a major influence of fertilization on the quality of the product. On the quantity, definitely. Basically, the less you feed the plants, the less tons you will get. So the 10 to 12 tons per hectare that I mentioned is within a reasonable medium fertilization. If you get, if you don't get, don't give any fertilization at all, you will not get 10 tons. But it is also possible to get like 15 or 17 tons, but it's just not cost effective. It's just better to grow a bit more hectares instead of, yeah, sorry, Ernest, Latvia, not Lithuania. Yeah.
That's okay. I have a question about sowing density and then I want to move on. I want to talk a little bit about how you've been successful in crowdfunding and you know what this looked like. But I've talked to me about sowing density for the textile grade fibers.
Yeah, if you ask the French guys or those working with long fiber, they'll say I'm doing it completely wrong because the theory is saying 60, 70 kilograms per hectare. What one has to keep in mind is that that's the people that are selling you the seeds telling that. So in their interest, it is that you use a lot of seeds. We are using 25 kilograms and each year we are experimenting with different sowing density, but that's like third or fourth year that I'm not changing it on the major part of the field because I'm actually very happy with it. I have not seen major differences in quality of the straw between 25 and 60 kilograms, and the cost is enormous. Like you pay 6 or 7 euros per kilogram. So if you use 70 kilos, it's going to be like 500 euro for the seeds only, which again, the end consumer is paying for it. Mm-hmm. So no need for that. But I'm speaking from the perspective of the farmer in a very specific climatic zone. We are actually below sea level. We have organic fields everywhere. So it is a very mushy kind of ground. So you cannot get too many plants in it. Even if we put 70 kilograms instead of 25 kilograms, we have the same number of plants. We still have around 100 plants per square meter. So what's the point of putting more seeds into the ground?
Sure. Okay, one more question about cultivating the field.
Yeah, that's actually pretty simple. Cultivating before sowing, it depends on the soil itself, not on the crop we are cultivating. So basically, we don't use a plow. I don't know the English word plow, like reversing the soil. We are not doing that. We just use a disc harrow, destroy everything that all the weeds because we don't use any chemical herbicides. Then we just sow it with a regular grain seeder and then just do nothing. Just post on LinkedIn and pictures for Facebook. That's the only thing that you actually have to do on the field. And then in February, depending on the weather, but after frost, if it's dry, around January to March, we just bale it, rake it and bale it. No cutting as is actually necessary because fortunately we have harsh winters. So at the bottom of the plant, there's a lot of snow. And if the plant is basically in the snow, it's got rotten at the bottom. Mm-hmm. Like it's completely destroyed. So then if you rake them, you don't need to really cut them. You just rake them and just bale them. So it is also very cost effective.
Interesting. Oh,
guys asking some difficult questions.
I like it.
I cannot answer it, Guy, because we're not doing durating because we tried it and we failed every single time. And of course, I'm the kind of guy that failures are like mistakes are a good thing because you learn from them. But sometimes you just have to say, no, that's not a good road to follow because in our climatic conditions, if you you cannot count on the weather in autumn, it rains a lot. And in many seasons, you don't have enough durating. For durating, you do need some moisture. Mm-hmm. But if you have moisture all the time and the material doesn't have any chance to dry properly to get baled, then you don't have any material. So what percentage of spinnable fiber you get from winter rating? Approximately 10 to 15% realistically. From durating, zero because it gets destroyed in the field.
Okay,
that's and good. And 10 to 15% might sound not a lot, because people are used to get 25 to 30% of fiber totally. But guy is asking for spinnable fiber, so basically you get a lot of loss. And at the moment, we are not concerned about it, because right now I just want to get to the end, to get the yarn, and then take a step back to optimize the process to reduce the waste. Right now, if I even have 5% or 10% of spinnable fiber, I will be happy with that, because then I can start working on getting each incremental change to increase the yield.
Well, and I think the redding piece is a huge discussion point that will come up a lot in 2023, as we're trying to figure out this, you know, bringing the material all the way to the spinner and what creates the best percentage as well as quality of fiber.
It's actually like the same history like with Tesla electric motors, taking the same discussion that it used to be 100 years ago with Mr. Edison. The discussion you're mentioning about retting, it used to be a huge topic in the 30s in Europe, like last 30s, 100 years ago. However cruel they have been, the Soviets and the Nazis in the 40s, they've been actually making a lot of progress on retting, on artificial retting, not on field retting, but forced retting. So we just kind of forgot all this knowledge, and then we're trying to get it back. So it will definitely be an interesting issue with lots of different attitudes, none of which is actually the solution. There is no one solution of retting. Depending on your local conditions, depending on your end goal, you can still operate in various ways.
So there's two questions on growing time and time it's sitting in the field between harvest and the redding. Are you growing into winter months? And then the next question is, how many weeks or months between baling in the spring and planting to the next season's crop?
Basically we plant April or early May, and then we collect it between January and March. So do we grow in winter? Well, we keep the plants in the field, but I wouldn't call it growing because they're already dead. The first frost comes around November, it kills the plant. And then that's the reason why we are using late flowering varieties, because in this way, we actually don't have mature plants. We have plants in the middle or beginning of flowering period, and then the frost is actually killing them. We are keeping them in the field for several months, and then come February, we are harvesting them. So how many weeks or months between baling and planting? That depends on the weather, because we are always planting end April, beginning of May, but when we can collect, it depends on when it is actually dry. It has to be below zero, but dry, because if it's above zero, our ground is not accessible. Being below sea level means you're actually in the mud, and it's not possible to collect straw from muddy field.
Interesting. Okay, very good. We've got all kinds of questions coming in. Rick, I wanted to see what you make sure I get to yours. I imagine redding yields the optimum methods, dew versus winter, will vary greatly, even in regions. Microsite factors are highly.
I definitely agree, and that's one of the reasons why I'm so focused on vertical integration and on sourcing it internally or locally. Because I am aware of the fact that if I get my company and just put it in like different part of Poland or like another continent, it probably will either it will not work or it will need some adjustments, some major adjustments. So that's why I'm always stressing it out in my posts on LinkedIn that we do it this way in Poland, but I'm not like a prophet saying that's the way you should be doing it. No, that's the way I'm doing it in my microclimate in Poland, in northeastern Poland.
And we've seen already, right, from in the U.S., from Montana to California to Texas, Florida, Louisiana, the climates are so different, and equally as much the genetics are impacted, right, because of daylight or where they're located. And so
one thing that people don't realize, because I've seen some interesting posts on LinkedIn comparing the different properties of the fiber grown from the same variety in different states. But one thing, unfortunately, if you buy the same variety 1 year to another, it might actually be different. It depends on how the seed producer is actually operating, because I know that French producers are making it very consistent. So if you buy it 1 year to another, it will definitely be the same. But with Polish growers, like, the institute is sourcing from 100 different growers, so they will have 100 slightly differing genetics, and it might also influence the output. Hannah was mentioning Fermion and other French varieties. I know you're happy to help because you already helped me, because I started Fibror growing from Hannah, so I strongly recommend working with her as well. Right now we're each year we are testing all the other varieties as well. It's like half of the field is production and half of the field is R&D. So like 2 hectares of a new variety, of a different fertilization scheme, of some ideas that I have, and we're just testing it.
Sure. Okay, back to Reading again. This is something that comes up a lot, the quality or the color of the stock and how it affects the quality of the fiber.
Guy, it's, I would say, maybe a fifth of the stalks are black or blackish, like some black dots on it. But I wouldn't really call them black. It's not the stalk that is black. It has some black spots on it. Mm-hmm. It is a kind of, because retting is basically, it's rotting. It's the same. It's just a different pronunciation. But it's basically microbial life on your product. It's the same as with, I don't know if you eat them in the US, but Camembert cheese. Like, you basically eat milk that got mold on it, but it's still a good kind of microbes. So with those black spots on winter retted hemp, it actually got removed completely during processing. So they are no longer black. So it's like, I'd say 80% are without those black spots or with little amounts of those. And those 20% are still eliminated, not totally as stems, the stalks, but just those black dots are just removed during mechanical or water-based processing.
Okay, one last question, and then I'm moving on because I want to hear about the crowdfunding, and we only have about 13 minutes left, 12 minutes left. Crop rotation. This is something that comes up a lot as we're looking at moving hemp and trying to buy away space from corn and soybean and other commodities. In general, how many consecutive seasons are you comfortable growing hemp in the same field? And what does your crop rotation look like?
I started actually growing it legally in 2015. And I'm growing in the very same field since then. And I don't see any signs of reduced yield of pathogens, pressure or whatever. But that's the reason, it's caused by the fact that I'm not a farmer, I don't own a farm, I'm a hemp guy. So I don't really have any use of introducing crop rotation on my field, because otherwise I would be only using my field like once every 4 years. And actually when we have been experimenting with contract farmers, which do use it in crop rotation, some of them were very happy with the yields of the following crop, saying it like removes some of the weeds and so on. But I've seen many cases of volunteer plants the following season, which are actually making life difficult for the farmer. If they grow corn, it's not a big issue because corn is also a very high crop, and you just collect it with forage harvesters, which can manage a few hemp plants. But if you're growing wheat with 30 centimeters stalk, and then every now and then you have 4 meter tree, then the combine harvester cannot actually work there. So you just have to go there manually or use some herbicides, which more and more farmers are disinclined to use because of the health related issues and both the EU policies to remove them from our fields.
I imagine this goes both ways from what I've heard, right? Depending on the crop that hemp follows, we may also have residual of, say, wheat in the hemp crop that then is harvested. You're not seeing that?
If you're growing for grain and you're using low varieties, that might be possible. If you're growing for flowers and you have very wide rows, then it's possible. But when you're growing for fiber, so one plant next to another and they're 3 meters, 4 meters tall, wheat has no chance. Absolutely.
Good. Yeah, that's great to know. Okay, so talk to me a little bit about crowdfunding. What advice would you have for people as they're building, you know, building their own business? What's worked and what did crowdfunding or the investors really need to hear to make this the go-to opportunity for them?
What I have to say to entrepreneurs, just do it. It's just so simple. But then don't think it will just give you money for free, because after we have had our success in crowdfunding, many companies followed, because we were the first hemp company to operate in this kind of funding model. Before that, it used to be almost exclusively craft breweries, because they started in this crowdfunding model. And then many people were saying, well, hemp is not suited for crowdfunding. But then I've been operating for 15 years in this industry. People know me. I had a successful exit from my previous company. So there is some kind of reason of believing that I know how to do business, and a long-term business, ethical business, and so on. And a lot of people actually believed it and wanted to be part of it. I'm 36 years old, and 3/4 of my investors are younger than I am. So those are the people.
Yes.
It wasn't huge amounts of money, because I have like 1,500 shareholders. So it's enough that the average person invested something like $1,000. It's not like a huge amount of money. It's something that they were aware it is at risk. It will be not you cannot actually make money out of it in 1 year or 2 years. I've been telling everyone, if you want a quick buck, just don't do it. Just don't invest. I don't want your money if you want it back quickly. I'm building a long-term business, and this attitude pays back, because those companies that followed me, not all of them, but some of them, they've been like, well, if we enter hemp business, it just gets a lot of money. Obviously, investors are not that stupid. People can differentiate between someone who's been in this industry for 20 years and he's actually, my whole life is devoted to it, and someone who just entered this business from completely another sphere and just want to make money out of it. Yeah. I'm not against making money. You need to make money to be able to do nice things. And I like doing nice things, and they're expensive, so I need money. Obviously, it was easier 2 years ago. The capital market was in a completely different situation. And I'm actually quite curious what's going to happen on Valentine's Day, because we are running our third crowdfunding share offering. The first one, €1 million. €1 million in Europe is a cap which you can actually finance this way. So the first time it took 42 minutes. Half of this time the servers were down because too many people wanted to buy the shares. The next time it was 7 minutes. So we are very enthusiastic, but at the same time cautious, because like capital. Raising capital became so much more difficult. So right now it's going to be a test for us, whether people on the tough market, whether people will still believe us and still believe our business model. Because truth be told, we are at the stage of investing money, not making money. So all the things I've been saying about fiber, like if anyone has some thinking going there, they realize that we are actually spending money. And if you don't produce yarn, you don't sell a lot of products. So we are actually still spending more than we are generating revenue. But I think that's the necessary step. And hope, and fortunately, among those 1,500 investors, almost absolutely everyone understands it. We are in a constant contact with them. And that's also a very interesting part of what people have to understand, the companies have to understand. It's raising money is not the goal. It's not a success by itself. It's only a beginning. It's actually a obligation towards those people. So I used to be a minor shareholder in many companies and stock exchange, and I've been really disgusted by the way they're actually making their investor relationship. It's, in most cases, it's not existent. We have a closed Facebook group. I'm actually telling them what we are doing, and it's only fair to them because they want to know, and they also want to feel a part of it, and they are happy seeing even like mundane things happening at our facility. But 3 years ago, 4 years ago, it was a bare ground. It was nothing. Right now we have 20,000 square meters of a facility, well, not indoor, but altogether the factory is 20,000 square meters, and they've seen they are a part of it. And when you show it to the people, then they actually, you can count on them when you go another year asking for more money.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and I think
you just have to think long term.
I think you made some really good points, you know, bringing up the impact investors and the younger generations, right? They're really who are seeing the pain points and have this drive to vote with their dollar.
And they all see that they will never see any retirement funds actually happening from the public
first. Yes.
And it's the same on both sides of the Atlantic, I believe, right? So people at my age and younger, they just don't believe in public schemes for retirement, so they have to take care of their own. So they're spending those small amounts of savings, which they otherwise they were just gonna spend it on consumption. So it's actually, I think I'm making a service to the economy in general, obviously in a small scale, but still it is nice to see people actually, that people are happy giving us money. Like it's obviously a very simplified way of putting things, but
yes,
impact investors. Yeah, I also like the term. I've never heard it before, but basically it describes very well this group.
Yes. Okay. So one last question. We only have a couple minutes left, but I want to dive into really real quick.
I warned you. Sorry.
I could keep going. It's not just you. Novel food and why the European seed producers get it wrong. Talk to me about what is novel food.
In the European Union in 1997, some idiot decided that if something was not on the market before 1997, it should be considered a novel food, and it needs some very precise safety data. It's almost as introducing a new medicine. As detailed, but basically you need to spend like 2 to 4 million euro on actually introducing a new food product. And in 1997, one of the hemp brewers in Germany asked the European Commission, is hemp considered novel? And the answer from the European Commission was obviously not. Like it has been with us for many, many, many years. And then come 2018, and the Commission is changing its stance and say, well, now it's novel. You just need to supply us with some documents. And the European Industrial Hemp Association, which is supposed to protect all the European hemp players, has actually agreed to this line of thinking. They got like huge amounts of money from the companies and started those trials 3 years now in the making, or 4 years or whatever, still no results. And it is actually admitting to the European Commission that yes, we agree it is novel and we want to prove to you that it is a safe novel food. No way, it is not novel. I've sent you I've seen it in the description of the webinar, ruling of the highest Polish court saying that the Polish sanitary inspection cannot force me to remove the product from the market just because they believe it was not on the market before 1997. So that's a very complicated matter, but lots and lots of money are being wasted on toxicological studies proving that something is safe that used to be consumed for hundreds and thousands of years in our culture. And you can never prove 100% that the people at the commission have this kind of mindset that they will always think, well, but maybe you didn't took into account something and something and something. For instance, with THC, they have a limit of THC in food products. and they based it on toxicological studies. How they did the toxicological studies? They took 12 dying AIDS patients and they started giving them THC, and they based their scientific findings on a dozen dying patients. Where's the scientific idea in it? Well, it's simply
variables.
There's not enough time to explain it in details, but basically, if you produce hemp CBD products, cannabinoid containing products in a natural way, which we are doing, just taking the hemp biomass, putting the vegetable oil and pressing it out, it cannot be considered novel. So if someone has, but what I do consider novel, and which is indeed novel, are all the crazy cannabinoids that you're selling in the US. All those Delta 10, 8, whatever. If you're actually changing nature, then it is novel. But if you're taking a plant that has been with humanity forever and you just make the oil out of it, it is not novel. It's as simple as that. Just don't make things too complicated and then life will be simpler for everyone.
I like it. Great job. Okay, so I want to real quick invite everyone to come back. Thank you so much for joining today. I'd love to do this again or catch up again, maybe 6 months or next year.
For those of you in the US, I will be coming in late March and early April to visit NoCo. And then I will have like 2 weeks traveling Kansas, Utah, wherever. So if anyone wants to meet and chat, then just write me on LinkedIn and I'll have plenty of time.
Yes, yes, I love this. Okay, where in Europe are you again?
Poland, non-eastern part of Poland, so basically the very end of European Union. Yeah. You know where Kaliningrad is?
No.
The Russian enclave is. Basically, if you take European map, we're something in here, like upper right corner.
Okay, just I like that. I get lucky enough and I get to go over to Europe and London, Paris, and potentially a couple of other places for about 10 days here pretty soon. And so I'll get in touch with you and just see if maybe it can map out, but I'd love to connect. Yeah. And if not, definitely during NoCo, I'll be around and would love to help make connections. Anybody else that's listening that hasn't joined Global Hemp Association or supported our fiber and grain variety trials, we are, I'd love to have you. I'd love to have you on. I'd love to interview. Also, anybody that you're looking to get to know or any questions that you have, I'd love to help you make those connections or get that information through our interview. So please don't hesitate to reach out. I'd love to support you guys. I'm excited about 2023 and everything that we have going. So Magique, is that right?
Close enough.
Thank you so much for joining. I appreciate you very much. I'm so proud of everything that you've done. It's exciting to watch. And please don't hesitate to reach out. If there's anything that we can do to support you, both while you're here in the US or over there, we'd love to do so. So thank you very much. Everyone else, we'll see you. I have a couple of great interviews tomorrow. Tomorrow, Dr. Craig, oh gosh, I'm going to butcher his last name also, is coming on from CSU Central State University. I don't believe it's Colorado State, but to talk about hemp as fish food and some of the studies that they've done for grain as a fish food. So we'd love to have you join. Same time, 10 o'clock, Monday or Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, every day, 10 a.m. Mountain Time for the next couple of months. We have great interviews lined up. So thank you very, very much. Anything else before we close off?
I think we've covered enough.
Thanks. All right. You're fabulous. Thank you very, very much. We'll talk later.